who believed that their loved ones were in competent hands. It's heartbreaking and horrible, and the slim connection to my father has provided his political enemies with endless emotionally charged ammunition. They want everyone to believe that if the pockets were deep enough, my father would use his influence to help a friend profit from human suffering and escape prosecution for it. Anyone who knows my father knows better. He isn't in a position to insist that supporters and campaign contributors offer up their balance sheets. And even if he were, the truth would be hidden beneath layer upon layer of corporate entities that look fine at a glance.
"Better brush up," Dad says,
and hits play on the voice memo. He holds the phone between us and leans my way, and suddenly, I'm 7 years old again. I get the gushy, warm feeling I always had when Mom walked me through the hallowed halls of the Capitol, stopped outside my father's door, and allowed me to go in alone. Very quietly, with great gravity, I'd march to the secretary's desk and announce that I had an appointment with the senator. "Oh, well, let me confirm that," Mrs. Dennison would say each time, lifting an eyebrow and restraining a smile as she picked up the intercom. "Senator, I have a Miss Stafford here to see you. Shall I send her in?" After I'd successfully been admitted, my father would greet me with a handshake, frown, and say,
"Good morning, Miss Stafford. Wonderful of you to come. Are you prepared to go out and greet the public today?"
"Yes, sir, I am."
His eyes always twinkled with pride as I twirled to display that I had dressed for the occasion. One of the best things a father can do for his daughter is let her know that she has met his expectations. My father did that for me, and no amount of effort on my part can fully repay the debt. I do anything for him, and for my mother. Now we sit shoulder to shoulder, listening to the details of the day's remaining activities, the topics that should be covered, and the issues that must be avoided. We're given carefully spun answers to questions about care facility abuse and foiled lawsuits and shell corporations that magically go bankrupt before damages can be paid out. What does my father intend to do about this? Has he been leaning on people, shielding political contributors and old friends from the long arm of justice? Will he now use his office to help the thousands of older adults who struggle to find quality care? What about those still living in their homes, dealing with damage from the recent historic flooding, forced to choose between taking care of repairs, eating, paying the electric bill, and refilling medications? What does my father think should be done to help them? The questions go on and on. Each comes with at least one well-scripted response. Many have several options we can use depending on the context, plus possible rebuttals. This afternoon's town hall forum will be a carefully regulated press op, but there's always the remote possibility of a mole sneaking to the microphone. Things could get heated. We're even told how to respond should someone manage to dig up the issue of Grandma Judy. Why are we paying for a facility that costs over 7 times the per-day amount that low-income seniors are allotted by Medicaid? Why? Because Grandma Judy's doctor recommended Magnolia Manor as our best option given my grandmother's familiarity with the place. One of her childhood friends lived on the estate before it was converted. And so it's like going home for her. We want her to have whatever will comfort her, but we're also concerned for her safety. We, like many families, find ourselves confronted with a complex and difficult issue for which there is no simple answer. Complex and difficult issue. No simple answer. I commit those lines to memory, verbatim, in case I'm asked. I'll be better off not trying to ad-lib when such deeply personal issues are involved.
Good op at the nursing home this morning, Wells,
Leslie comments when she slips into the car during a coffee stop a few blocks from the venue.
We're on our way to nipping this thing in the bud.
She's even more intense than usual.
Let Cal Fortner and his team try to make mileage off this business about senior care. They're only putting out the rope we'll hang them with.
They're putting out plenty of rope.
Dad's joke falls flat. There's a well-thought-out attack plan in the opposition's camp. A systematic strategy of painting my father as an out-of-touch elitist. A Washington insider whose decades in D.C. have left him blind to the needs of the people in his home state.
More for us to work with, Leslie answers confidently. Listen, slight change of plans. We'll be coming into the building from the back. There's a protest underway across the street from the entrance.
She shifts focus to me then.
Avery, we'll bring you on stage for this one. We're doing the forum with the senator seated across from the host, for a casual feel. You will be beside your father on the sofa, to his right, the concerned daughter having moved home to look after his health and manage the family's business concerns. You're the one who's single and not busy raising children. You have a wedding to plan here in Aiken, etc., etc. You know the drill. Nothing too political, but don't be afraid to show your knowledge of the issues and the legal ramifications. We're looking for a relaxed, unscripted tone, so the opportunity may arise to filter a question of a more personal nature your way. Only local news outlets will be present, which makes this a perfect chance for you to gain a little face time without too much pressure.
Of course. I've spent the last 5 years with juries scrutinizing my every move and defense lawyers breathing down my neck. Participants in a carefully monitored town hall meeting do not scare me. Or so I tell myself. For some reason, my pulse is racing, and my throat feels rough and dry.
Game face, kiddo.
Daddy sends me what we sometimes call the million-dollar wink. It oozes confidence like warm honey, thick and irresistible. If only I had half of my father's charisma. Leslie moves on with the briefing for the event. She's still talking when we arrive at the hall. Unlike the nursing home appearance earlier, there's security this time, including local DPS officers. I can hear the commotion out front, and a squad car sits at the end of the alleyway. Leslie looks like she's ready to punch someone's lights out as we're hustled from the limo. A nervous sweat beads under my conservative navy suit.
Honor thy father and mother!
A protester shouts above the din. I want to hang a right turn, march to the curb, and tell these people off. How dare they?
No concentration camps for seniors!
That one follows us through the door. What are these people, nuts? I mutter, and Leslie gives me a warning look, then shrugs covertly toward the police officers. I'm being told to keep my opinions to myself in public, unless they're pre-approved. But now I'm fighting mad, which may be a good thing. My pulse slows resolutely, and I feel my game face settling into place. The minute the door closes, things calm down. We're met by Andrew Moore, the program coordinator for the hosts of today's forum, a seniors' rights pack. Andrew seems surprisingly young to be in such a position. He can't be past his mid-twenties. The neatly pressed gray suit combined with slightly askew necktie and haphazardly bunched shirt collar make him seem like a boy whose clothes were laid out for him in the morning, but who had to get into them himself. He tells us that he was raised by his grandparents, who made huge sacrifices to provide for him. This is his way of giving back. When someone mentions that I was a federal prosecutor, he eyes me and quips that the PAC could use a good attorney on staff. I'll keep that in mind, I joke. We make a bit more small talk while we wait. He seems likable, honest, energetic, and committed. My confidence that this will be a fair discussion of the issues ratchets upward. Other introductions quickly take place. We meet the local reporter who will act as our moderator. We slide microphones under our jackets, clip them to our lapels, and hook the transmitter boxes over our waistbands. We wait in the wings while the host takes the stage, thanks the organizers, then reminds everyone of the format for today's forum before finally introducing us. The crowd applauds, and we ascend the stage, waving cheerfully at the audience. Everyone is well-behaved, though looking out at the group, I see quite a few faces that seem concerned, skeptical, and somewhat unfriendly. Others eye the senator with what could only be classified as hero worship. My father does a reasonable job of responding to the simple questions and deflecting a few inquiries that can't be answered in a soundbite. There are no easy solutions to the problem of funding retirement years that last much longer than in previous generations, or the issue of fractured families, and the cultural shift toward relying on professional care rather than tending to senior relatives at home. Despite the well-thought-out replies, I can tell that he's a little off the mark today. He's a bit slow when a young man asks, "Sir, I'd like to hear your response to Cal Fortner's accusation that the goal of corporate-owned senior care chains is to warehouse the elderly in the cheapest way possible so as to increase profits, and that your repeated acceptance of campaign contributions from L.R. Lawton and his investment partners indicates your support of this profits-over-people model. Do you acknowledge that in these facilities, seniors were tended to by minimum-wage workers with little or no training, if they were seen to at all? Your opponent calls for federal legislation to hold anyone who profits from a care facility or its holding companies personally accountable for the care provided there, as well as any damages awarded in lawsuits. Fortner is also calling for taxes on wealthy individuals such as yourself to fund an increase in benefits for our poorest senior citizens. In view of recent events, would you support this in the Senate? And why or why not?" I can almost hear Leslie gnashing her teeth behind the curtain. Those questions weren't anywhere in the script, and no doubt they're not on the index card the guy is holding. My father hesitates, appearing to be momentarily bewildered. "Come on," I think. Sweat drips down my back. My muscles tense, and I clutch the armrest of my chair to keep from fidgeting. The silence is agonizing. Minutes seem to pass, but I know it's not that long. My father finally launches into a lengthy explanation of the existing federal regulations on nursing homes and the taxes and federal trust funds that pay for Medicaid. He seems competent and unruffled, once again in charge. He makes it evident that he is not in a position to single-handedly alter Medicaid funding, the tax code, and the current state of senior care, but that these issues will have his foremost attention in the next Senate session. The forum then returns to a more acceptable script. A question eventually comes my way, and the host looks at me indulgently. I give the prescribed response about whether or not I am being groomed for my father's Senate seat. I don't say yes, and I don't say never in a million years. Instead, I end with, "In any case, it's premature to even think about it, unless I want to run against the man himself. And who would be crazy enough to do that?" The audience chuckles, and I follow up with the signature wink I inherited from my dad. He's so pleased. He looks 10 feet tall as he responds to a few more simple questions, and the discussion wraps up. I'm ready for pats on the back from Leslie as we exit the stage. Instead, she catches me with a worried look and leans close as we walk out the door.
The nursing home called. Apparently you lost a bracelet there.
What? A bracelet? Suddenly, I remember putting one on this morning. There's no movement on my wrist. And yes, the bracelet is gone.
One of the residents was found with it. The director looked at her cell phone photos from the event and determined that it was yours.
The woman in the nursing home. The one who grabbed my hand. Now I remember the tiny gold legs of three little dragonflies raking down my wrist as May Crandall was pulled away. She must have ended up with my jewelry.
Oh, I know what happened. The director apologized profusely. The patient is new and struggling to adjust. She was found 2 weeks ago in a house along the river with her dead sister's body and a dozen cats.
Oh, how horrible. My mind takes flight, and I see the dismal, gruesome scene, even though I don't want to.
I'm sure it was an accident. The thing about the bracelet, I mean. She grabbed my hand while we were listening to Daddy. The nurse sort of had to peel her off.
That shouldn't have happened.
It's okay, Leslie. It's fine.
I'll send someone to pick it up.
I remember May Crandall's blue eyes. The way she regarded me with such desperation. I imagine her coming away with my bracelet, examining it alone in her room, draping it over her wrist, and admiring it with delight. If it weren't an heirloom, I'd just let her keep it.
You know what? I think I'll go back and get it myself. The bracelet was my grandmother's.
The day's agenda calls for my father and me to part ways from here. He'll be spending a little time at his office before having supper with one of his constituents, while my mother hosts a DAR meeting at Drayden Hill.
Is there someone who can drive me? Or can I take one of the cars?
Leslie's eyes flare. I'm afraid we're about to lock horns, so I add a more compelling excuse.
I should run by and have tea with Grandma Judy while I've got a little time anyway. She'll enjoy seeing the bracelet.
The town hall forum has left me feeling guilty that I haven't visited my grandmother in almost a week. Leslie's jaw twitches as she acquiesces, making it clear that she finds my silly whim disturbingly unprofessional.
I can't help it. I'm still thinking about May Crandall and remembering the plethora of newspaper stories about nursing home abuse. Perhaps I just want to make sure that May didn't come to me because she's in some sort of trouble. Perhaps my curiosity has been piqued by her sad, macabre story. She was found 2 weeks ago in a house along the river with her dead sister's body. Was her sister's name Fern?
Chapter 4. Real Foss. Memphis, Tennessee, 1939. Queenie is as pale as skimmed milk, her body tight and hard as Briny lays her on the edge of the shanty porch and goes after the skiff, which is tied up to a drift pile down water. Queenie cries and screams out of her head, her cheek pushed to the smooth, wet wood. Lark backs herself into the night shadows by the shanty wall, but the little ones, Fern and Gabian, saddle closer on hands and knees. They've never seen a grown person act this way. Gabian leans down to see, like he's not sure this thing in Queenie's pink-flowered dress is even her. Queenie is light and laughter, and all the old songs she sings with us as we travel along from one river town to another. This woman with the bared teeth and the cuss words and the moans and sobs can't be her. But it is.
Where?
Gabian says, because it just too, he can't say my name real. He grabs my skirt hem, tugging at it as I kneel down to hold Queenie's head.
Queenie Owl?
Hush up! Camellia slaps at the little kid's hands as Fern stretches to stroke Queenie's long gold curls. It's the hair that first caught Brownie's eye and made him set his sights on her. Don't your mama look like a princess in a storybook? He asks me sometimes. Queen of Kingdom Arcadia, that's your mama. That makes you a princess sure enough, don't it? But my mama's not beautiful now. Not with her face sweat-streaked and her mouth twisted in pain. The babies are busting her open. Her stomach clenches and bulges under the dress. She grabs hold of me and hangs on. And inside the cabin, the midwife wipes her hands, gathering her birthing tools in a grass basket. You gotta help her, I scream. She's dying. Ain't having nothing else to do with this business, the woman says, her heavy body rocking the boat and making the lantern sway and sputter. No more, fool river trash. She's mad as a camp town dog because Brownie wouldn't pay her cash money. Brownie says she promised to deliver a baby, which she didn't. And she ought to be glad he's letting her take the two fat catfish he pulled off the trot lines earlier in the day, plus some coal oil for her carry lamp. She'd get back at us if she could. But she's still blacker than tar and we're white, and she knows what could happen if she gives us trouble. The catfish was supposed to be our dinner, which leaves us with nothing but one little cake of corn pone between the five of us. That spins through my mind with a half dozen other things. Should I gather up clothes for Queenie? The hairbrush? Her shoes? Has Brownie got enough money to pay a real doctor? What'll happen if he don't? What if the law nabs him? Once before, when we were hustling pool halls in river towns, he got snagged. Brownie's a good hustler. There's nobody can beat him at a game of eight ball. And he can play a pool hall piano good enough that people will pay him to do it. But this depression has made cash hard to come by. Mostly now he hustles pool and plays for things he can trade off to get what we need. Is there money hid somewhere? Should I ask Brownie when he comes back? Remind him he might need it? How will he make the trip across river in the dark with the storm already lifting white caps on the water? The midwife turns sideways to get out the door, her basket slapping her behind. Something red hangs out the top, and I know what it is, even in the dim light. Queenie's pretty velvet hat with the feathers on top. The one Brownie won in a pool game in a dirty little place called Boggy Field. You put that back, I say. That's my mama's. The woman's dark eyes fold up in her face, and she wags her chin at me. Done been here all day long, and I ain't gonna be taking no two fish. I gots me enough fish. I take this hat. She looks around to see where Brownie's at, and then she starts for the gangplank at the side of the porch. I want to stop her, but I can't. On my lap, Queenie screams, thrashing around. Her head lands on the deck with a hollow thud, like a watermelon. I grab her with both hands. Camellia hurries ahead of the woman and stretches herself across the gate, her thin arms stretched from rail to rail. You ain't taking my mama's hat nowheres. The woman moves another step, but if she knew Camellia, she wouldn't. My sister might be only 10, but she didn't just get Brownie's thick black hair. She got his temper to go with it. When Brownie gets mad, he's blind fool mad, old Zed calls it. Blind fool mad is the kind that'll get you killed on the river. Zed's warned my daddy of that more than once when our boats have been tied near each other, and a lot of times they are. Zed's been Brownie's friend since Brownie first took to the river. He taught Brownie the way of things. You lil saucy thing, sass mouth. A big dark hand clamps over Camellia's arm, and the woman yanks her up, and Camellia clings onto the rail so hard, I think her shoulder bone's bound to snap from the socket. 2 seconds don't pass before Camellia whips around and sinks in her teeth. The woman howls and stumbles back, rocking the boat. Queenie screams. Thunder rumbles far off. Lightning flashes, and the night turns to day, then puts on its black veil again. Where's Briny? Why's he taking so long? A bad thought hits me. What if the skiff broke loose and Briny can't find it? What if he's gone to borrow one off somebody in the shantyboat camp? Just for once, I wish Briny wasn't so stuck on keeping to himself. He never ties up in the river camps, and folks who know our boat know not to come calling unless they're invited. Briny says there's good folks on the river and folks you can't trust, and it's best to figure out who's who from a distance. Queenie kicks and knocks Gabian over, and he bangs his arm and howls high and long. Lark bolts inside the cabin to hide now that the midwife is clear of it. Queenie's dying right here in my arms. She's gotta be. At the head of the gangplank, Camellia ain't budging. The sneer on her face dog dares the woman to try her again. Camellia would just as soon fight something as look at it. She'll catch snakes barehanded and scrap with the boys in the river towns and not think twice about it.
You leave my mama's hat, she yells over Gabian squalling. And you don't need no fish, neither. Just get off our boat before we go on and find the police and tell them some colored woman done tried to kill our mama and steal us blind. They'll hang you up a tree, they will.
She lets her head go slack and lolls her tongue, and my stomach turns heavy. Just 2 weeks ago Wednesday, we saw the man hung in the tree downriver. Big colored fella in overalls. There wasn't a house round for miles, and he'd been there long enough the buzzards had got after him. Only Camellia would use something like that to try to get her way. It makes me sick just thinking about it. Maybe that's why Queenie's in a bad way now, a voice whispers in my head. Maybe it's all because Briny didn't stop and cut that man down and find his people so's they could bury him proper. Maybe it's him looking on from the woods now. Queenie begged Briny to go up to the shore and take care of the body, but Briny wouldn't. We got the kids to think about, Queen, he said. No telling who did that to him, or who's watching. We best get on down the river. The midwife snatches Queenie's red hat from her basket, throws it down, and walks over it, her weight rocking the deck as she wobbles down the gangplank, then grabs the lantern she left on shore. The last thing she does is take the stringer with the 2 catfish. Then she wanders off, cussing us all the way.
And the devil can come get you too,
Camellia echoes back at her, hanging over the porch rail.
That's what you get for thieving.
She stops short of repeating the woman's naughty words. Camellia's eaten enough soap to clean up the inside of a whale in her 10 years. She's practically been raised on it. It's a wonder bubbles don't pour out her ears.
Someone's coming. Hush up, Gabian.
Grabbing Gabby and slapping a hand over his mouth, she listens into the night. I hear the sound of a motor, too.
Go look if it's Briny,
I tell Fern, and she hops up to do it. But Camellia shoves Gabby at her instead.
Keep him quiet.
Camellia crosses the porch and leans over the waterside rail, and for the first time, I hear relief in her voice.
Looks like he's got Zed.
Comfort wraps me like a quilt. If anyone can make things all right, it's old Zed. I didn't even know he was here around Mud Island, but Briny probably did. They always keep track of each other on the river one way or another. Last I'd heard, Zed was inland, seeing after her sister who had to move to a sanatorium because she had the consumption.
Zed's here,
I whisper to Queenie, leaning close. She seems to hear, maybe settles a little. Zed will know what to do. He'll calm Briny's wildness, push the clouds from my daddy's eyes, and get him to think.
Zed's here, Queenie. It's gonna be fine. It's gonna be fine.
I repeat it over and over until they're pitching the line to Camellia and climbing the gangplank. Briny crosses the porch in two steps, falls to his knees beside Queenie, and scoops her up, bending his head low over hers. I feel her weight leave me, her warmth vanishing from my skin. The night dew closes in, and all of a sudden, I'm cold. I stand up and turn the lantern higher, and wrap my arms tight around myself. Zed squats down close, looks Queenie in the eyes, unwraps the sheet a little, and there's blood everywhere. He lays a hand on her belly, where a watery red stain rises up her dress. Miss Foss, his voice is steady and clear. Miss Foss, you hearing me now? She lets out what might be a yes, but the sound dies behind clenched teeth, and she buries her face in Briny's chest. Zed's mouth turns grim inside his thick gray beard. His red-lined eyes hang loose in their sockets. His breath sucks in through wide, hairy nostrils, then pours out between tight lips. The smell of whiskey and tobacco hangs heavy, but it's a comfort. It's the one thing about this night that's like always. He locks eyes with Briny and shakes his head a little. Queenie girl, we're gonna get you off of the boat, you hear me? Gotta carry you on down to the hospital in the Jenny. Be a rough trip across water. You be a brassy gal for me now, you hear? He helps Briny lift her from the floor, and her screams tear the night like the women shredding funeral veils down in New Orleans. She goes limp in Briny's arms before they can even get her in the boat. Hold her now, Zed tells Briny, and then he looks at me and points the crooked finger that was broke in the Spanish War. You take the youngins in the shanty house, and you get them all to bed, sis. Stay inside. I'll hist on back here for morning if the storm holds off, but if and it don't, the Lizzie May is tied up down water just a bit. Your skiff's there. Got a boy on the Lizzie with me. He's a rough looker just now. Tried hoboing the train, and the railroad bulls got after him. He won't hurt you none, though. Told him to row on up here come morning, if and he didn't hear elsewise from me. He cranks the water witch motor, and it rumbles to life, and I stare at the sludge churning in the lantern's glow. I don't want to see Queenie's eyes closed and her mouth hanging slack that way. Camellia casts off the line, and it lands neatly in the John boat's bow. Zed points a finger Camellia's way. You mind your sister, little spitter. You don't do nothing without asking real first, you savvy? Camellia's nose scrunches up so tight the freckles on her cheeks run together. You savvy? Zed asks again. He knows which one of us is most likely to wander off and roust up trouble. Camellia! Briny's clouds clear a minute. Yes, sir, she agrees. But she ain't happy about it. Briny turns to me then. But it's like he's begging me, not telling me. You watch over the babies, Real. Keep care of everybody till we get back. Queenie and me.
We'll be good, I promise. I'll look after everybody. We won't go nowhere.
Zed turns the tiller handle and cranks up the throttle, and the water witch carries my mama away into the dark. All five of us hurry to the rail and stand there side by side, watching until the blackness swallows the Jenny whole. We listen while the hole slaps over white caps, rising and falling, the kicker roaring and quieting and roaring again. Its voice gets a little farther away each time. Off in the distance, the tugs blow their foghorns. A boatswain's whistle sounds. A dog yaps. The night turns quiet. Fern wraps around my leg like a monkey, and Gabby wanders inside the cabin with Lark, because she's his favorite. Finally, there's nothing more to do but go in the shanty and figure out how we're gonna eat. All we've got is this one corn pone cake and some pears Briny traded for over in Wilson, Arkansas, where we stayed 3 months and went to school until it let out for summer. By then, Briny had the itchy feet again. He was ready to take to the water. Any normal time, he'd never bring us to shore nearby a big city like Memphis. But Queenie'd been complaining of cramps since day before yesterday, even though it was sooner than she figured it should be, after 5 babies. She knew we'd better tie up the boat and stay put. Inside the Arcadia now, everyone's whiny and worried and hot and cranky. Camelia complains because I've shut the door instead of just the screen, and it's sticky hot, even with the windows open. "Hush up," I hiss, and get the dinner ready. And we sit in a circle on the floor, all 5 of us, because it doesn't seem right to be at the table with 2 spots empty at the end.
"I'm hungry,"
Gabian's lip pooches out after his food is gone. He eats faster than a stray cat. I tear off a scrap of my corn pone slice and twirl it close to his mouth.
"You gobbled yours up too quick."
He opens up like a bird every time I get near, and finally I pop the bite in.
"Mmm,"
he says, and rubs his tummy. Fern plays the game with him, and so does Lark. By the time it's all over, Gabby's gotten most of the food, except Camellia's, because she eats all of hers.
"I'll run the trot lines in the morning," she says,
like that makes up for her selfish streak.
"Zeed told us to stay put," I say. "When Zeed gets back or the boy comes, then I'll do it."
She can't run the trot line by herself, and she knows it.
"The skiff ain't even here. Briny rowed it down to Zeed's boat."
"It will be tomorrow."
"Tomorrow, Briny'll be back. And Queenie, with the babies."
We look at each other then. Just Camelia and me. I feel Lark and Fern watching us. But it's only us two that understand enough to share the worry. Camelia looks toward the door, and so do I. We both know that nobody's gonna walk through it tonight. We've never stayed alone in the dark before. There's always been Queenie, even when Briny was gone hunting or hustling pool halls or gigging frogs. Gabian topples over onto Queenie's braided rug, his eyes closed, long sandy brown lashes touching his cheeks. I still need to get a diaper on him for overnight, but I'll do it after he's out cold, just like Queenie does. Now that Gabby's using the potty during the day, he gets mad if we come at him with a diaper. Outside, thunder booms and lightning flashes, and the sky starts to spit out mist. Did Zeed and Briny make it across water with our mama, I wonder? Is she someplace where the doctors can fix her? The way they did Camelia when her appendix went bad. Batten down the windows that are toward the river. No sense rain coming in, I tell Camelia, and she doesn't even argue. For the first time ever, she's lost. She's not sure what's best. The problem is, I'm not either. Gabian's mouth falls open and he starts to snore. That's one of the little kids, at least, who won't be raising a fuss tonight. Lark and Fern are another matter. Lark's big blue eyes fill up and she whispers,
"I want Queenie. I'm scared."
I want Queenie too, but I can't tell them that.
"Hush up now. You're 6 years old. You're not a baby. Close the window before the wind starts blowing, and get your nightie on. We'll change the big bed and sleep there, all of us. Just like when Briny's gone."
My body's boneless and weary, but my mind is running crazy. It can't think a clear thought. It's just spinning up nonsense words like the water witch turned in the shallows, stirring leaves and twigs and bait grubs and muck. It keeps on so that I don't hear all the whining and complaining and sniggling and sniffing and Camelia egging it on by calling Fern a ninny and Lark a baby and another dirty word she ain't even supposed to say. Last thing, once they're all in the big bed and I turn the lanterns down, I take the Tin Man's cross off the floor and hang him back on the wall where he belongs. Briony hasn't got any use for him, but Queenie does. And tonight, he's the only one here to watch over us. Getting on my knees before I climb into bed, I whisper every word of Polish I know.
Chapter 5. Avery. I'll only be a little while, I tell Ian, Leslie's intern, as he parks under the nursing home portico. He stops halfway out the driver's side door. Oh, okay. I'll just sit here and take care of some email, I guess. He seems disappointed that no escort is needed. I feel his curious gaze following me as I exit the car and make my way through the lobby. The director is waiting in her office. Grandma Judy's bracelet lies on her desk. The dragonfly's gemstone eyes glitter as I slip the lost treasure back onto my wrist. We chat a bit about the day's event before the director apologizes for my trouble. "We've had quite a time with Mrs. Crandall," she admits. "Poor thing. For the most part, she doesn't speak to anyone. She just wanders the halls and the grounds until lockup at night. Then she stays in her room, unless the volunteers are here to play the piano. She does seem to love music, but even at the sing-alongs, we can't persuade her to engage with the other residents. Grief and a change of location can often be more than the mind and body can handle." Immediately, I imagine someone saying the same thing about Grandma Judy. My heart aches for this poor woman, May. I hope she isn't upset. I'm sure she didn't take the bracelet on purpose. I would have let her keep it, except it's been in the family for so long. Oh, goodness, no. It's best that she gives it back. One of the things our residents sometimes have difficulty accepting is that many of their belongings haven't come here with them. They tend to see things around the facility and think someone has made off with their possessions. We return heisted goods quite often. Mrs. Crandall is still adjusting to leaving her house. She's confused and unsettled right now, but it's natural. I know that's a hard transition. My grandmother's estate on Lanyap Street is still closed up with everything inside it. We haven't been ready to decide what should happen to a lifetime of mementos and countless family heirlooms. Eventually, the house will pass down to the next generation, as it always has. Hopefully, one of my sisters will move in, and most of the antiques can stay. Does Mrs. Crandall have family who come to visit? I purposely don't mention the story about the dead sister. I already feel guilty talking about this woman as if she's some sort of case study. She's a person, like Grandma Judy. The director shakes her head, frowning. No one locally. Her son passed away years ago. She has grandchildren, but it's a remarried and blended family, and none of them live nearby, so it's complicated. They're doing their best, and to be honest, Mrs. Crandall hasn't been making it any easier. She was taken to a facility closer to her home to begin with, and she tried to run away. The family moved her here thinking that a bit of distance might help. She has attempted to leave us 3 times in 2 weeks. Some amount of disorientation and difficulty isn't unusual for new residents. Hopefully, she'll improve once she has adjusted a bit. I'd hate to see her transferred to the Alzheimer's unit, but... She clamps her lips over the sentence, apparently realizing that she's not supposed to be telling me all of this. I'm so sorry. I can't help feeling as if I've made a bad situation worse. Could I see her, just to tell her thank you for returning my bracelet? She didn't return it, exactly. The nurse found her with it. I'd at least like to tell her I appreciate having it back.
Mostly, I'm just concerned that the director seems so clinical about all of this. What if I've stirred up trouble for May? The bracelet was one of my grandmother's favorites. I looked down at the ornately fashioned golden dragonflies with their garnet eyes and multicolored spines.
We don't restrict our residence visitors here, but it might be better if you didn't. Mrs. Crandall most likely wouldn't speak with you anyway. We'll let her know the bracelet was returned and everything is fine.
We end the conversation with a bit of pleasant chatter about the birthday party earlier, and then we part at her office door. On the way back to the entrance, I pass a hallway sign with names and room numbers neatly arranged in metal slots. May Crandall, 107. I turn the corner. Room 107 lies at the end of the hall. The door is open. The bed in the front half of the room is empty. The curtain in the middle has been drawn. I step in, whisper, "Hello, Mrs. Crandall?" The air smells stale, and the lights are off, but I hear the raspy sound of someone breathing. "Mrs. Crandall?" Another step, and I can see feet protruding from the blankets on the other bed. The feet are shrunken and curled, as if they haven't borne weight in a long time. That must not be her. I study the area that is undoubtedly Mrs. Crandall's. It's small and bland and somewhat depressing. While Grandma Judy's new mini apartment is outfitted with a sofa, a chair, and a game table, and adorned with as many favorite photos as we could fit, this room looks as if its occupant has no intention of staying. Only one personal item sits on the bedside table. A photo frame with a faded, dusty velvet stand on the back. I know I shouldn't be nosy, but I can still see May looking up at me with her robin's egg blue eyes, seeming to need something. Desperately. What if she's tried to run away from this place because someone is mistreating her? As a federal prosecutor, you can't help being aware of horrible elder abuse cases. When federal crimes such as telemarketing fraud, identity theft, and the pilfering of Social Security checks are involved, the cases fall under our jurisdiction. There are too many instances where young people are just waiting to get their hands on the older folks' money. Mrs. Crandall may have perfectly wonderful grandkids, but it's hard to imagine why they would leave her alone here in this condition instead of moving her to some place where one of them could monitor her care. I just want to be sure, I tell myself. There is, inbred in me, the Stafford sense of duty. It makes me feel responsible for the well-being of strangers, especially those who are helpless and marginalized. Charities are my mother's full-time, unofficial second job. The ornate frame is turned toward the wall, unfortunately. It was molded from the sort of pearlescent ivory celluloid that would have matched ladies' powder jars and brushes, combs and button hooks back in the 30s and 40s. Even leaning over, I can't see the photo. Finally, I just do it. I turn the frame. Sepia-toned and bleached white around the edges, the image is a snapshot of a young couple on the shore of a lake or pond. The man wears a battered fedora and holds a fishing pole. His face is difficult to make out. Dark eyes, dark hair. He's handsome, and the way he stands with one foot propped on a fallen log, his slim shoulders cocked back, speaks of confidence. Defiance, almost. It's as if he's challenging the photographer to capture him. The woman is pregnant. The wind catches her floral dress, outlining a stomach that seems too large to be carried on her long, thin legs. Her thick blonde hair hangs in long spirals almost to her waist.
The front of it is pulled up in a bedraggled bow, like a little girl's. That's the first thing that strikes me about her. She looks like a teenager dressed up for a role in a school play. The Grapes of Wrath, maybe. The second thing that strikes me is that she reminds me of my grandmother. I blink, lean closer, think of the photos we carefully hung in Grandma Judy's room not long ago. There's one in particular, an image from her high school graduation trip. She's sitting on a pier at Coney Island, smiling for the camera. I'm probably just imagining the resemblance. Judging by the clothing, this photo is too old to be of Grandma Judy. My always fashionable grandmother would never have been dressed that way, but right now all I can think as I peer through the glass is, that could be her. I also see the resemblance to my niece Courtney, and, of course, to me. I whip out my cell phone and try to get its camera to focus in the dim light. The camera's crosshairs weave in and out. I snap a photo. It's blurry. I shift toward the bed. Try again. For some reason, turning on the lamp feels like stepping over the line, and if I use the camera flash, it'll just glare off the glass. But I want a photo. Maybe my father can tell me if he recognizes these people. Or maybe, once I get home and look again, I'll realize I'm overthinking the resemblance. The picture is old, and it's not that clear. It's rude to invade someone's space without being invited. I jerk upright before the camera snaps again, and the phone slips loose. It tumbles end over end, and I'm like a cartoon character moving in slow motion, grasping at air. May Crandall makes her way through the door while I retrieve my phone from under the bed. I'm so sorry. There is no good explanation for this. None. What are you up to exactly? When I turn, she draws away, surprised. Her chin turtles into her neck, then slowly pokes out again. You came back. Her visual sweep takes in the picture frame, telling me that she knows it's been moved. Are you one of them? Them? These people. A hand flits through the air, indicating the nursing home staff. She cranes closer. They've got me in prison here. I think of the story Leslie told me. The house, the dead sister's body. Maybe there's more than just grief and disorientation involved here. I really know nothing about this woman. I see you have my bracelet. She points at my wrist. The director's words come to mind. For the most part, she doesn't speak to anyone. She just wanders the halls and the grounds. But she's talking to me. I catch myself pulling the dragonfly bracelet close, holding a hand over it, pinning it against my chest. I'm sorry. The bracelet was mine. It must have slipped off when you held my wrist earlier. Today, at the birthday party? She blinks at me as if she hasn't a clue what I'm talking about. Maybe she's forgotten the party already? Did you have one like it? I ask. A party? No, of course not. Her resentment boils just below the surface, potent and acidic. Maybe the nursing home director has underestimated this woman's problems? I've heard that dementia and Alzheimer's can manifest in paranoia and agitation. I've just never experienced that behavior. Grandma Judy is confused and sometimes frustrated with herself, but she's as sweet and kind-hearted as ever. Actually, I meant, did you have a bracelet like this?
Why, yes, I did. Until they gave it to you.
No, I was wearing it when I came here this morning. It was a gift from my grandmother. It was one of her favorites. Otherwise, I would have... I stopped before saying, otherwise, I would have let you keep it. It seems like it would be disrespectful, as if I'd be treating her like a child. She stares long at me. Suddenly, she seems completely lucid, acute even.
Perhaps I could meet your grandmother, and we can iron this out. Does she live nearby?
There's an abrupt change in the atmosphere of the room. I feel it, and it has nothing to do with the vent kicking on overhead. She wants something from me. I'm afraid that isn't possible. I wish it were, but it's not. In truth, I would never expose my sweet grandmother to this strange, bitter woman. The more she talks, the easier it is to imagine her holing up with her sister's body.
Is she gone, then?
Suddenly, she seems crestfallen, vulnerable. No, but she's had to move out of her house and into a care facility.
Recently?
About a month ago.
Oh, what a shame. Is she happy there, at least?
A beseeching, desperate look follows the words, and I'm hit with a penetrating sadness for May. What has her life been like? Where are the friends, the neighbors, the co-workers, the people who should be coming to see her now, out of duty, if nothing else? Grandma Judy has at least one visitor per day, sometimes two or three. I think she is. To tell you the truth, she was lonely in her home. Now that she's at the facility, she has people to talk to, and there are games days and parties she can attend. They do craft projects, and there is a library with plenty of books. No doubt, they offer some of those options here. Maybe I can gain a little mileage with May Crandall, encourage her to give her new life an honest try and stop battling the staff. The shift in our conversation is leading me to suspect that she's not as addled as she's been pretending to be. She smoothly ignores my implication and changes the subject.
I believe I knew her. Your grandmother. We shared bridge club, I think.
She points the knuckle of a bent, craggy finger in my direction.
You favor her quite a bit.
People say so. Yes. I have her hair. My sisters don't, but I do.
And her eyes.
Things turn intimate. She looks through me to the very marrow of my bones. What is happening here?
I'll ask her about you when I see her, but she may not remember. She has good days and bad days.
Don't we all, though?
May's lips twitch upward, and I catch myself chuckling nervously. Shifting, I hit the bedside lamp with my elbow, then catch it, knocking the frame this time. I grab it before it can fall, hold it, and try to resist taking a closer look.
They're always bumping that. The girl's here.
I could put it over on the dresser.
I want it close to me.
Oh, okay. I wish I could sneak a new phone photo. At this angle, there's no glare, and the face looks even more like my grandmother's. Could it be her? Maybe dressed up for a play? She was president of the drama club in prep school.
I was wondering about this, actually, when you came in.
Now that we're on friendlier terms, it seems permissible to ask.
The woman in the picture reminds me of my grandmother, a little.
My phone buzzes, still on silent from the town hall forum.
I'm reminded that I've left Ian waiting in the car all this time. The message is from my mother, though. She wants me to call her.
Same hair.